I am Plata on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. This Saturday is the gala screening for this year's Crazy Eights film competition. Over 8 recent days, 6 crews made 6 short films. They were chosen from many applicants, with semi-finalists chosen by a jury of industry professionals. I'm joined now by 2 members of a team, Lee Shorten, the writer and director of the film Parabola. With him is a producer on the project, Phil Planta. He was on last year when another film he produced, Gemini, was in last year's competition. I'll ask Mr. Shorten and Mr. Planta about this film, about the themes explored therein, guilt, forgiveness, and family. In the short, Makoto, a Japanese-American single mother, struggles to reconcile with her dying estranged father. Makoto is played by Mayumi Yoshida, Mr. Shorten's fellow cast member from The Man in the High Castle, a show where Musashi, the estranged father, played by Hiro Kanagawa, also appears. Lee Shorten is a writer, director, and actor who grew up in Australia. He gave up a career in law to pursue work in the film industry. Other than The Man in the High Castle, he has appeared in Supernatural and Van Helsing, among many other credits. His Twitter handle is at LC Shorten. Phil Planta is a producer, filmmaker, and VFX artist. Some of his credits include Once Upon a Time, Revolution, Twilight, Breaking Dawn Part 2, Big Eyes, and Red 2. Other short films he's produced include Final Wishes, which won first prize at the Vancouver Asian Film Festival. His Twitter handle is at Phil Planta, and if the surnames didn't give it away, we're related, we're cousins. You can see Parabola and the other 5 films this Saturday night, the 23rd of February, at the Center here in Vancouver. Visit crazy8s.film for tickets and information. For the $35 admission, you'll get to see the films and gain admission to the after party at Science World later that night. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Lee Shorten. Mr. Shorten, good morning.
Good morning. You can call me Lee.
I can't. Okay. Thank you very much. Please welcome back Phil Planta. Mr. Planta, good morning.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm great.
So I asked Lee before we started how to pronounce a thing. I thought it was a parabola, but it's parabola, right?
Well, that's how I pronounce it. A lot of people say parabola. I'm actually a big fan of accents, maybe having been Australian and now having this kind of American accent. So however people want to say things is up to them, I think. It's a beautiful thing.
What's the word from, though, or what is the word?
I believe it's Greek, I think, but it's a mathematical term. It's basically that U shape.
You know. And without giving anything away, I guess it means something to what the film's about, right?
Yeah. I think I like kind of films that don't give you all the answers, films that you kind of have to engage with and talk about afterwards. So I think after you've seen the film, maybe the title will mean more to you.
You're the film's writer and its director. As its writer, how do you come up with the premise of what the film's about? I mean, I touched on it in the introduction, but it's probably more than that, isn't it?
This one kind of had a bit of a strange genesis because, you know, a lot of the times it starts with an idea. This started with, you know, I'd worked with Mayumi Yoshida and Hiro Kanagawa on Man in the High Castle, and they're just two of my good friends, and I just wanted to write something for them, basically, was how it started. And then from there I thought, well, you know, Hiro has had this huge career. I mean, the guy's a veteran character actor. He's got like 175 credits. But when you look at his credits, man, no one has really even allowed him to begin to show what he can do. He's a phenomenal character actor. And of course, you know, the way the industry is, him being this really handsome, you know, Asian guy with a lot of gravitas, he plays a lot of like stoic characters and a lot of yakuza and gangsters and thugs and whatnot. So I thought, how can we subvert the expectations around him and his career? So what if we drew upon his body of work? So he's already played all these, you know, gangsters. And how can we take that and then subvert it? So I thought, what about if it's this gangster at the end of his life and he regrets all the things that he did? So that would allow Hiro, you know, freedom to play in a different way. So then I thought, well, then what's the flip side of that? Well, how do we explore that kind of regret? Well, it's probably through family and through having a daughter. And then, of course, when you look at Mayumi, she's another talented actress and who hasn't been allowed to show everything that she can do. And, you know, Asian women typically either the sassy chick with the colored hair, or they play the very model minority reserve that don't do anything. So again, how can we subvert that expectation? So instead, you know, we look at like the Jessica Jones and Emma Stone from Maniac. These girls who are a bit more damaged and have a bit more attitude. So then, what happens if we give that to Mayumi and then just allow them to go at it?
And Phil, how did you come to the project in terms of producing this short film?
I was actually pretty reluctant to go into Crazy Eights again, just because, you know, a little bit of PTSD. and actually, we never talked about, because last time you interviewed me was
it was before. Yeah, the 8 days.
And after, I was exhausted and just, really spent and thought I would never do this again. But I think what really turned it around for me was, I'd been approached by several teams to commit as a producer, and I kind of let people know, well, let's see what happens. Let's see who gets from top 40 to top 12, yeah, and then top 12 to whatever. And what got me was Lee's video pitch, which I hadn't seen, and he finally sent it to me, and I was like, oh, this sounds really challenging and interesting.
Yeah.
So I had to reevaluate my position and think about, could I do this movie, which had 7 locations in 3 days and so many different moving parts, like sets being built in these houses and then taken down right away, and then moving half the crew to another location while the other one's setting up and that sort of thing. It was just a challenge that appealed to me, and yeah.
But you guys knew each other before?
Yeah, so what happened was, I think near when Lee had just moved into town and kind of graduated from acting school, he was volunteering at the Vancouver Asian Film Festival, and there was a red carpet, and my film, Final Wishes, actually it was before Final Wishes.
Yeah,
it was actually Contaminant. It was my first film that won in the Asian Film Festival. And he was interviewing me about it. He was the red carpet interviewer,
yeah,
volunteering. And also he was the host introducing the films as well. And I remember thinking, this guy's really interesting. Like, and I had seen him in this other film where I thought his Australian accent was fake. And I said, that is a Asian guy, but he's actually from Australia.
Yeah.
And I contacted him like a year later, and we did the film Final Wishes, and we won with that one. And right after that, he introduced me to Mayumi, and said she's looking to apply for this Storyhive grant for $10,000. And we hit it off, and we made that film, and it did really well in festivals. And then about after Gemini, last year's Crazy Eight, the Storyhive had opened up again, $10,000 grant for short films. And we all met Mayumi, Lee, and some of our other group to pitch ideas to each other. And I told everyone, pitch. And Lee had a great story, and I told him, send it to Mayumi. I think she'll like it. And he sent it, and we made that film and won the Storyhive grant for $10,000. And that was kind of like the beginning of the writing bug for Lee, I would say. Yeah. And then I think what happened was, after seeing the success with Mayumi and myself, our group of friends were like, there's possibilities. We can actually, you know, they had a role model to look up to, or peers that they had seen, you know, just other Asian actors or filmmakers expanding into writing and directing. And so that kind of spurred him on to apply for Crazy Eights. And I always say, you know, if you don't play the lottery, you don't have a chance to win. So I was like, might as well try. You know, and it was out of 200 applications.
Yeah, 200, yeah.
And he got to top 40 and then top 12. And then I couldn't believe it. We got into top 6. And one of our good friends also got into the top 6 as well. So, you know, if we hadn't tried, who would know? The film had been made, right?
And then that's something that for people listening to us. It's a good piece of advice if you want to get into films. You just really have to pitch, and you have to really work at it, and you'll get there. Lee, you had a career in law. You studied law. You were a lawyer for a bit. Then you decided to go into acting. Is that right?
Yeah,
Yeah. And so what's the transition then from being an actor to, say, wanting to write and direct? Is that something that you always wanted to do, say?
Sort of. You know, it's funny. Like, now that I'm here and I look back, it all seems to make a lot of sense. I used to write a lot as a kid, like a lot of short stories. And, you know, and writing was kind of my first creative outlet. But then for whatever reason, I stopped writing. But when I went to university, my liberal arts undergrad major was film studies. Mm. And that's kind of where I really fell in love with film. And at that stage, I thought if I was ever going to get into film, it would be directing. But then I went to law school and all that stuff happened. And I got into acting just, I don't even know really how I got into
it. Did you not like law?
Oh, no, I hated it. And I knew I was going to hate it. But it's that classic Asian thing, right? You finish high school and your parents are like, well, it's law school or med school. And you look around and you look at television and you see like one Asian actor out of, you know, thousands. And you're like, well, maybe mom and dad are right. The odds of that being a reality are so slim. So I went into law, but then did it for a while and just really hated it. And I was almost 30, and I just thought, I saw my whole life ahead of me, and I thought, if this is the last chance I have to maybe give it a shot, and then if it doesn't work out, I can go back and be a lawyer and kind of get back on that track.
You've got a trade to fall back
on. Yeah, but if I don't shoot this shot, you know, maybe in 10 years I'm going to wake up and be like, why didn't I do that, you know? Yeah.
The thing that Lee just mentioned that I think we touched on this before in our discussion last year, Phil, was you really can't. I guess a lot of people get, dejected when they look on their television screen or their movie screen and not see someone that looks like them, and I guess that's always been a goal of yours in terms of one, getting into the business and doing the sort of projects that you've been doing. Is making that space and the importance of making that space, right?
Yes, it's definitely like I said last time. I'm not banging a diversity drum, but if no one else is going to make it, I'm going to make it. With Asian crew and Asian filmmakers and Asian actors, for me, I see it as an advantage, not a disadvantage. I see so many stories that are different from what we can see on TV right now or film. And, for myself, I love the short film format because it's pretty tight and you have to really focus in on telling the story. And, you can get a crew to commit to that short amount of time to produce a really good product. And you have time to refine the story and get the actors, really tight as opposed to, I guess, working outside of indie film.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, definitely for me, the last, since we last talked, I did 3 Story High films, and we won the $10,000 grant for each of those. And the actors and the filmmakers were all of Asian descent, Asian-Canadian mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And I think each time we created really original stories that you might not see on any other platform. So, thank you, obviously, Tell a Story Hive. But and after that, I my next film is also starring Andrea Bang of Kim's Convenience.
Mm-hmm.
And, just because the actors and the writers are Asian, we want to kind of showcase different things as well, like not necessarily specifically about Asians, or mm-hmm. Asian culture. It just, they happen to be Asian and that sort of thing.
And you mentioned Andrea, she's got a film at Crazy Eights.
Yeah, so she was co-writing now, and it's really funny how she helped out on one of the other Story Hives I did, and they became friends, the director Jerome Yu, and I produced Jerome's Story Hive as well last year, and it's just great to see him growing as an artist and also applying and winning Crazy Eights as well. And then now engaging Andrea to help co-write. And then now our next film, which is called In Loving Memory, that won the Bell Media Foundation mm-hmm. Grant, Harold Greenberg. And that was $20,000 to produce a short this year. And what I did was the director, Diana Bang, who's the sister of Andrea,
yeah,
and you might know her from the interview,
right?
I hooked her up with Mayumi and Yoshida from our film, and they're going to co-direct, and Andrea's writing and starring. So I'm creating this almost like a coven, I guess, a coven of filmmakers. And we had a picture that someone reposted, and it was of all of us, and Mayumi commented, "Oh, wow, we're all directors now."
Yeah.
You know, and it was just amazing to see these actors transitioning, Asian-Canadian actors transitioning into directing and telling their own stories and becoming filmmakers and expanding, you know, into, you know, the storytelling they want to tell.
Now, Lee, do you find when you're within the business, say, I mean, do you notice a great change in terms of the people, the different kinds of people that we're seeing working?
Yeah, I definitely think so. The last couple of years have been a real kind of tipping point, I think. You know, you look at, say, the success of Black Panther, which is now the highest grossing Marvel title. No, that's a single hero, not like Avengers or anything. And you couldn't have even fathomed that a few years ago. And you know, Crazy Rich Asians, and even just having, say, John Cho front the movie like Searching.
Mm-hmm.
It is, I think, the industry. It is a business, right? At the end of the day, and they're looking around, and there's so much competition now. There's so much streaming, and there's so much going on. So they almost have no choice but to be like, how can we think outside the box? So all these people who have traditionally been on the out, now they're looking at them being like, well, if you've stuck in here for 20 years and we've barely given you anything but table scraps, you must be pretty damn good at what you do. So why don't you come sit at the table now and tell us what's up? So
let's talk about the film Parabola. It has I haven't seen it, obviously, but from what it's been described as, it has a neo-noir feel to it. We all seem to know what noir is. What's the neo part?
So you look at film noir, and it's got a very classic, traditional thing, and you've got your femme fatale, and you've got your hard-boiled detective, and, you know,
bad guy, good guy, yeah.
Bad guy, good guy. Traditionally, it's, you know, a crime thing. Neo-noir sort of came about. Blade Runner is considered the first neo-noir film, and that it used the tenets of that genre. You know, Deckard is essentially a hard-boiled detective, and you could argue that Rachel's a bit of a femme fatale, but it's that it's exploring more philosophical themes about what it is to be human, and then, of course, it's set in the future as opposed to more of the period piece. So that was kind of the first one, and then neo-noir then tends to be applied to anything that sort of has a noir feel or noir elements but isn't, strictly speaking, film noir.
And in terms of your own interest, we were talking just before we started, I'm 36, and I got into really wanting to watch everything I could in that genre the last few years. I mean, is that the same experience that you have with, say, you and your friends?
I had got into it a lot back in film school. I mean, you know, like, that was the best thing about doing film studies. I say film school is film studies.
Yeah.
You know, so I wasn't learning to make films. I was learning to critique films.
Uh-huh.
And there was a whole kind of, you know, unit about it. But I think it has an appeal for people our age, because you're at that point where you really are starting to understand the complexities of the world and the shades of gray, and you're looking for a way to either explore that or to escape from that. And so depending on which kind of noir you're watching, it's either helping you navigate the grays of the world, or it's presenting a very black and white picture that allows you to escape from the complexity of your life.
The rap that noir gets, though, is that it's largely for guys. And I'm assuming from the characters in this film of yours, it's not, right? At the heart of this story, it's the mother, right?
Yes, absolutely.
The daughter, I should
absolutely
say.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like anything, you know. Traditionally, men have dominated every level of the film industry, from the writers to the producers, directors, studio heads, everyone. So I think that's in large part why it traditionally, like most genres, have traditionally outside the rom-com been male films. But
yeah,
when you look at film noir again, if it's just about a certain set of characters and a structure, there's no reason, I don't think, why that couldn't be female, you know.
Yeah. Did you were you attracted to work on this project, Phil, because you like the subject matter or the theme, say?
Definitely, yeah. When I saw his pitch and the way he talked about the pitch with such passion, and I, you know something's going to be good when the pitch catches you. You haven't seen. You're imagining the images. Yeah. And he was talking about this neo-noir style Asian Yakuza type film, but not in the traditional way. So it's almost like, if I can compare it, I like to joke, it's like This Is Us, but in a Yakuza background.
Ah, there you go.
It's a bit of a drama, you know, like there's, you know, a chance to get the feels, as they say. But
so I will cry.
Possibly, you know, it depends how cold your heart is. You know. But it was definitely something like I could picture in my mind, and our editor Dom, when he was telling me about it, he's like, "Yeah, I'm going for like kind of a Christopher Nolan Memento feel." Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen Memento, it definitely falls in that category, you know, shifting of time and place, and almost a circular nature to the storytelling, like many noir type films.
As a producer, I guess you have to see that before everything's done, and that must take great, I don't know, foresight's the right word, but some level of vision, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely, for me, it's trying to think of what can I source to make this vision come true, and that's not just the places, but also the people. The right people is critical. Like, for example, our composer Samuel Kim, he could get that noir type soundtrack,
uh-huh.
but also infuse it with Asian influences, mm. which was really unique. And it's you know, you might not get that with a certain type of composer. You have to kind of play the balance. And then same with the locations with our co-producer Theo Kim. He knew what kind of feel for the type of bars or environments we're looking for, so he suggested, you know, many that he knows, and they all worked out in terms of great production value. And the if you see the film, you'll see they kind of fall to those classical film noir feelings, and even the way the cinematographer frames the shots is very still, no handheld,
yeah.
Very slow moving, graceful type movements. Very, very still in some ways compared to other films.
So you're the writer and the director of this, Lee, but it's still very much a collaboration, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. I would be nothing without the team that we've assembled. It's I don't think people appreciate how much it is a collaborative effort. You know, like a lot of people want to be like you know, a Christopher Nolan film or a Martin Scorsese film. And, of course, I don't want to take away from the genius of those two people, but I'm sure even they would admit that it is a huge collaborative effort. And if I don't have a brilliant production designer, when we show up on the day, I'm pointing the camera at nothing. So then what is that?
Yeah.
If I don't have a brilliant cinematographer, well, then mm-hmm. When I point the camera, it's ugly, even if I have a good production designer. Mm-hmm. And if I don't have wonderful actors, then the story isn't sold. And it just keeps going on and on and on down the chain. It is like a jigsaw puzzle, you know. Mm-hmm. If one piece is missing, it is not complete. Or if one piece is in the wrong spot, mm-hmm. you do not have the finished puzzle. You just have a collection of crap on a desk.
Mm-hmm. Does the script change at all? While you're filming it, or I guess the 8 days, you have to be pretty disciplined.
Well, they say a film is made three times: mm. once in the writing, mm-hmm. once in the shooting, and then again in the edit. And I think it is like that. The shooting is the blueprint for what you're going to do, but so many things go wrong and are changed on the day, or actors come with different ideas, or you see something on the day that you couldn't see until you're there. So you got to be flexible. You have to know what you need and what the core of your story is, but then you're flexible to any ideas that happen and making changes. And then you've shot a bunch of footage, and then that becomes the next blueprint. And then you go to the edit, and you're like, this is what we have. How can we shape this into the best story from the pieces that we have? So at every stage, those three stages, it's like it can be a completely different beast.
Yeah. Well, is there a difference in terms of the way you work? I mean, as an actor as opposed to a director? I mean, do you... Are there directors that you emulate, say, the minute that you walk onto set?
I think I often compare actors and directors to, like, we're at war. Not necessarily with each other, but, like, it's like we're all trying to win a war.
Yeah.
And as an actor, you're like a soldier in the trenches. So your job is to be in the trench, and you're looking at who to shoot, and you're looking at, like, when to throw the grenade, and you're looking to do all these things, and that is your job. as the director, you're like the general. So you're like, we need to take this hill. We need to send 20 people over here. We need an airstrike, right? And I think problems become when people get confused about how to best serve that story. Because the director shouldn't be in an actor's ear or a soldier's ear, like being like, oh, you should shoot that guy. You should throw a grenade right now. That's not his job. Mm-hmm. And an actor shouldn't be thinking, why are we trying to take this hill, right? Like, they just have to take the hill. So having been both, I think, is the interesting thing. And even before, as an actor, I would always make my choices and do my work as an actor, but then try and step back and look at the big picture and be like, are these choices I'm making as an actor aligning with the broader strokes?
You mentioned, Phil, a moment ago, last year's competition. You mentioned you were reluctant to get into it again. PTSD is something you cited. What was it like going into to this year's competition, and did you find that it was easier at all?
In some aspects, it was a little bit easier because I knew what we were getting into, and I wanted to give Lee a chance to succeed, you know, just because his project was ambitious. And compared to my last year's, there, you know, last year we stayed in one warehouse and shot indoors. Mm-hmm. This year we had to deal with weather, and we had to deal with, you know, driving a crew of 55 people from different houses or different locations and unloading that gear at each and reloading it after each shot or, you know, set of shots were finished. So logistically, this was more challenging, definitely. And, you know, some of the decisions we had to make really on the fly and adapt. And that was one thing I said, you know, let's not rush. You know, we may have to compromise on the day, but, you know, we'll adapt. And don't rush because you'll make mistakes, right? You'll break something or lose something or forget something or, you know, someone will get hurt. So that was a big thing for me, just making sure that we kind of balance, you know, the tightness of our schedule with you know, our ambition, you know, kind of curb your ambition and get just what you need. And just an example, we shot in a nightclub and the fire alarm went off. So obviously you can't record sound. And, you know, the firemen came and they checked it out and they're like, okay, you guys are okay. But the problem was, the fire alarm, they didn't know how to turn it off. So we couldn't shoot any sound. And he was, Lee was pretty stressed, and I just pulled him aside and I said, okay, we're going to do this Hong Kong style. We're going to shoot with no audio, right? We'll just shoot, you know, and we'll add the voices later, you know, in ADR, dialogue recording separately. And then once he flipped to that, I just saw his mind changed and said, okay, this is what we're going to do. And we had a limited time because we'd been waiting for the fire department to clear us to shoot. And he just flipped and said, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to shoot this way and this way. That's it. And then we have to run to the next location. So it's those kind of things or circumstances that, you know, just happen on the day that, you know, that kind of scared me, you know, beforehand. But and I, you know, I'm gonna have nightmares now after. But you know, when you look at it, the bigger picture,
yeah,
you know, sometimes those things help you in a way because you have to limit yourself. And you know, the, you know, our DOP was stressed out, and but then she had to focus in. Okay, this is the shot, you know, and this is exactly what we need. Nothing more, nothing less.
Oh, so you had a female.
Yes, we had a female cinematographer. Her name's Angelica. And that was a big thing for us to have.
Absolutely.
Inclusion. And she's also diverse. She's from Mexico. And we worked with her on Lee's last short film that he wrote in Miami and Natch directed. And I think it's great to, especially in the competition this year, I think there's two female directors of photography out of six. You know, so we're getting there, and it's important to for, you know, especially women to see, you know, as a role model. This, she's in charge. She's, you know, calling the shots, literally calling the shots. You know, and great for, you know, a great platform for her to show off her work. And we got her all the best tools. I joked with her one time. I said, didn't I get you everything you wanted and more? We had a a crane on a top of a car.
Yeah.
We had a helium balloon light that was probably, I don't know how big. It must have been.
I don't know, it was big.
Yeah, like a 10-foot balloon.
Yeah.
Helium light. And, like, just the crane on the car alone, you know, that's probably, like, you know, upwards of 10,000 a day or more.
Yeah.
And the balloon as well, you know, it's thousands of dollars per day. But that's the great thing about Crazy Eights is they give you opportunities to get these things.
Yeah, that's the one thing that struck me in talking about Crazy Eights over the last, and this is the third year now that I've been talking about this festival, is that it is a competition. Yeah, there's a great deal of goodwill amongst the teams themselves and the film, the larger film community altogether, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think like everyone sees it as a rite of passage. And, you know, after we got in, a lot of us were saying, you know, don't stop pitching. You know, every filmmaker who made it through, you know, to the final round with us or even the round before, it's important. Like, that's part of the job. If you want to be a filmmaker long term, you got to always pitch. It's just something you have to get good at, just like writing. You have to get good at pitching. That's part of the job.
What is it likely when just listening to Phil talk about cranes and lights and balloons and the sort, to be there? I mean, did you take a moment and you're able to see that this stuff was all in your head and now it's being realized in the form of a film?
Yeah, it's a very surreal and rewarding experience. But more than anything, and this is me, and this has always been me as a creative person or in general, like, all I feel is responsibility. Because the more things we get, and the more people who come out for us, and the more money, the more toys, the more everything, then all I do is feel more responsibility to make sure we're getting what we need, to make sure that it was worth it, to make sure that people were having fun, to make sure that we didn't put these huge crews through 3 days of an intensely stressful, you know, experience for nothing. So, yeah, all I feel is responsibility.
Yeah, and it was definitely an education for you, wouldn't you say?
Oh, 100%. 100%.
So it hasn't dissuaded you from, say, wanting to do more or, say, bigger projects like this?
No, and in fact, you know, like, I'm a big trial by fire, deep end person. Like, that's how I like to learn. Because, you know, sometimes it's the best way because you really learn whether you have it or not. And, yeah, I made a lot of mistakes on this film, so many, and I would have made even more if I didn't have people like Phil and Brittany there to help me out. You know, I was probably learning lessons over the 3 days that maybe other people wouldn't learn until they've directed for a year or something. I don't know. It's hard for me to fairly compare their experience because I don't know them. But now that I will reflect and take stock, and I'll talk to my team again about what we didn't want to say to me on the day because I was stressed, you know, and I'll try and learn some more lessons. But I think as long as I keep improving, not just, you know, as a technical filmmaker, but as, you know, the director is the leader and sets the tone on set, the more I learn to be a better person, I think I'll keep going.
Do you still act?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so when people ask you what you do, I mean, what how do you describe yourself? Are you an actor or are you a director or writer?
I don't know. I don't really tell people much. I don't really like talking about myself,
a little
to
modest,
be honest.
But definitely an actor filmmaker, I'd say.
Yeah. I don't know. When people ask me what I do, I generally say something self-deprecating, like, I don't know. I say other people's words for a living.
But so, he was actually on The Terror, like his biggest, I guess you would say, booking during our shoot, like in between our shoot days. Like, he actually got booked on a big show shooting here in Vancouver downtown, right?
Yeah.
And
so you had to act while you were doing this, or no?
Yeah, like, you know, I had 2 days of shooting the week leading up to our shoot,
yeah.
And then we had our shoot, and then I was on set like 3 days while we were doing post, and it was very intense.
So he would do a 12-hour day and then come check what we were editing or working on, and that's very challenging, just because you're shifting your mindset. And
it must involve a lot of trust in terms of your collaborators, right?
Well, yeah, and I think that's the thing, you know. Sometimes I think there's this idea that directors are these iron-fisted tyrants and we're just executing their vision. Yeah. But, again, talking back to what we said, I think it's a collaborative thing. And my go-to always is we're all prisoners of our own perspective, right? I can only see things or understand things based on my upbringing. So, of course, I want to see what Phil has to say, and I want to see what my editor brings to the table, because they can see and think and feel things that I would never have thought of. And again, maybe because I have the overall vision, of what it should look like, maybe I'll be like, oh, that's a really good idea, but I don't think it's right for this. But I would rather they feel empowered to present their stuff, because, I mean, I will say this film structurally changed significantly in the edit. And while some of that was my idea, a lot of that was my editor's idea. A lot of that was our assistant editor's idea. Some of that was, you know, other producer Brittany's idea. So, you know, for someone to slap, like, a film by, you know, Lee Shorten on it would be an insult to everyone who worked on this film.
You mentioned your co-producer Brittany Lum Cho. And I was just reading the notes here. The three of you have come to film from different walks of life previously. I mentioned law for you, Lee, and Phil, you've done other things in the past. Mm-hmm. The lure of film, it seems inevitable if you're a fan of film at a young age or you studied it, say, but it's not that easy a road, is it? Or not clear a road, I should say.
No, definitely not. I always say it's a lifestyle, not a career.
Mm.
And you have to be at peace with the control you lose over choosing that lifestyle. I mean, especially like in the actor's case, you really are at the mercy of, you know, how much you can get out there, and even then, you know, not getting chosen for a role and just kind of accepting that. And, you know, whereas I always say is like for, you know, young filmmakers and even actors now is, you know, write your own content, make your own content, because that's where you regain that control. But it is a huge investment of time. It's a huge investment of your passion and your efforts. So, you know, you better enjoy it. You know, it's like, I mean, not so different, I guess, from podcasting. And, you know, like, how much time do you put into this? And the things behind the scenes that people don't see, you know, and all the moving pieces that people don't necessarily appreciate or know about. That's filmmaking to me, is just being passionate about the whole process and appreciating, you know, what you get out of it.
So. And there have been no regrets on your part, Lee, in terms of leaving law and continuing this career in whether you're an actor or writer or director in the future, right?
No, absolutely not. I love it. I love everything about filmmaking. It stresses me out, but I literally love everything about it, and I can't imagine doing anything else.
Yeah. So the future does look bright for especially in this town, in terms of say the ability of an actor to book projects and the amount of work there is, right? I mean, there's so many streaming platforms, the traditional networks, if you will.
The problem with this town, and this is a generalization.
Sure.
You know, there's always, you know. Generally speaking, most of the big roles, they bring up L.A. actors.
Mm.
So for you, there is something of a glass ceiling here. And, you know, there's always be acceptance to that. But as a general observation, I think that's true. So hopefully that changes. But, yeah, look, you couldn't work a lot. But at the end of the day, look, if I booked 20 roles this year and they were all like cop number two, mm-hmm. I would not be a happy person. I'd rather book one guest star than do that. So it just depends on what you want from your life. Because I know – I have a lot of friends who do that, and they love that. They love just booking a bunch of shows and going in for 1 or 2 days, and that fulfills them. And there's no disrespect there. If that what makes you happy. In the same way, if you want to be a doctor or if you want to be, you know, the manager of Starbucks and these things make you happy and you prioritize other things, I respect that. But I know for me, I'm not happy to do that. I need something to sink my teeth into. So we'll see what happens.
Phil mentioned that film is a lifestyle rather than a career. Because it is a lifestyle, then, for both of you, do you watch film differently as a result?
I do, definitely. You know, some films I watch, you know, 10 times, 12 times.
Yeah.
and, you know, see what I can get out of them or watch, you know, leading up to this, I sent Lee a lot of Kubrick video essays and David Fincher type essays, just on his films and, you know, video essays on sound design and color that's where I, for me, you know, since now I can appreciate how hard it is to make a film. I'm not as heavy a critic, I would say.
Mm.
So, you know, I don't critique it so hard. Sometimes, you know, if it's a Marvel film and I don't like it or
sure.
something like that, or a DC film, actually. Definitely, I have an appreciation for the craft and the different departments. And even on this film, I can definitely say Lee saw the work that our departments put in. We had, you know, at least 20 people working in our art department, you know, just building the set or taking care of props. And it was just a lot of work, you know, and a lot of people, a lot of moving parts.
Yeah.
Like we were putting wallpaper on existing walls.
Really?
And then taking it down. Yeah. And, moving furniture in and out. It was like moving, like a moving company.
Yeah.
The big thing for me when I watch films now, I'm looking for what is the abstraction, you know, what is the thing that is more than the film, you know, like this book you have on your desk, Under Vancouver, which is a book I love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the photographs transcend just being a photograph. There's art within that, and so that's what I look for in films, like something that will cause me to have some sort of feeling,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to just be an observation, you know. So,
Lee, when you watch a movie, are you watching the actor or are you watching how they're directed?
Everything.
Really?
Yeah, I think, again, it comes back from having done film, like studied it from a critical perspective first. I'm constantly looking at why they've chosen this color palette. How come they're cutting into coverage here? Why are they favoring this actor here? Why did that actor make that choice? How come this is a one-er? Why didn't they decide to tell it in traditional coverage? How does this camera pan enhance the feelings of this moment? Like, why is this scene silent? How come the score kicks in here? Like, I am never not thinking as much as I can, which makes it really hard. Like, a lot of people watch films to unwind. I can't because I just can't switch that off. So I have a problem.
The one thing I was just thinking about is when we look at certain films, we can see certain directors and how they work. Like, you think of a Willy Wyler movie, say, or a Scorsese film. It has that look to it. Mm-hmm. Why don't we see that on television, say?
It's starting to. I think you're getting more directors, especially... because in TV, the system's a little different. You have showrunners, and showrunners hire a team of writers. So, you know, something... For me, I think something gets a little diluted there.
A Shonda Rhimes show could have 22 different directors.
Yeah, right? Like every season, you know, and some of the sometimes the stars direct, you know. So it's how do you favor the look and feel that's established by, say, a Shondaland type produced series, you know, and they have some editing techniques and they have, but you know, the creativity is spread thin in a way, you know, but. You know, when you look at, for example, say True Detective season one, you can clearly see the difference between that and season two, and that's because there was the director who helmed all the episodes, and then in the next season, it was completely different directors, and like something gets lost sometimes in translation, I would say, but you're starting to see it now. Like when you look at, Hannibal was a great series or a great example. It just favored the taste of the creator, and you know, and when I look at some of his other work, like Pushing Daisies and that sort of thing, you can see how he pushes to the surreal. So that's when it's, I think, you can see the high art coming into certain series.
Yeah.
But then some series don't favor that, or they have a different game plan. You know, they follow a formula.
Yeah, even The Sopranos, for example, you notice this when you binge it. I guess you did notice it when you I don't know if you notice it if you watch it week to week, but if you binge it, you certainly notice the tone changes from one. Yeah, and the stories, even something that it ended on a cliffhanger the mm-hmm. week before, completely ignored or not ignored, but mm-hmm. it's a different focus the next time around.
Well, yeah. I think it is too. Like a film, right? We'll go and we'll pitch it. It'll get greenlit, and then we'll go and shoot it in isolation. Then we'll cut it together, and then we'll present it to the audience. Mm-hmm. Whereas because TV is real time, that's why that happens, mm-hmm. right? Because you can be flexible. Because mm-hmm. you're like, this is going to be the vision, and then episode one airs, and everyone hates it, and you look at all the feedback, and suddenly yeah. you've got critics' reviews, and you're seeing what's trending, and you're like, oh, shit, everyone hates that character. Even though we had a 10-episode arc planned after that character, well, now he's going to go away. And I think TV then tends to be, because of the nature, more willing to change and adapt on the fly for better and for worse.
You can find stories, yeah, definitely find stories as the season goes on and shift the stories, yeah.
When I have film or television or other creative people on, I always like to ask them what they're watching at the moment and what they're enjoying. Is there something that comes to mind? Hey, you've been very busy these last few days. I doubt you've had time to watch anything, but...
You know, lately I thought Maniac was really good. I just finished Russian Doll. I thought that was phenomenal. And I'm just about to start Umbrella Academy.
I've heard good things about that one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just finished Counterpart, which was fantastic with J.K. Simmons. And I love how they ended the second season, or how the second season is going. Before that, I really liked, I think it's called The Chi or The Chai.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that was a really well weaved together and really great character acting. And I just watched, what's that series called? Deadly Class, just because it was shot in Vancouver. Mm. And it was really nice to see Vancouver look different.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that a lot. Like, I could tell they spent a lot of money on
Deadly Class, that's what it's called?
Deadly Class, yeah. Based on a Image Vertigo series or something like that. Yeah, but comic book type thing.
Yeah. Russo Brothers, exactly. Russo Brothers. Benedict Wong, yeah. Lana Condor.
Mm-hmm. Of these Oscar films, have you seen any of those that are nominated for this week's Academy Awards?
Yeah, I've seen a few of them.
Was there anything that jumps out at you?
I don't know. I thought, what was the best film? I thought Shoplifters was the best film I saw last year, actually. And I think it's only up for foreign films.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a Japanese film, right?
Yeah, Koreeda.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I saw Roma. I mean, did you?
I did. I liked Roma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I liked Roma, too. And but you know, it's definitely not for everyone's taste, and I think that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just watched the film. I forgot who the director. I think it's called The Florida Project.
Oh, the Willem Dafoe film.
Yeah, and I thought that was really interesting. How they set up the premise and the characters and the style of it. I wouldn't say it's my favorite film, but I just appreciated it.
Yeah, I started it, and then I tweeted about it, saying that I rather enjoyed it. And then someone said some snark on Facebook or Twitter said that it's poverty porn.
People say that about I get that because I was pitching ideas for films shooting in the Philippines, and they say the same thing. They're like, "Don't shoot poverty porn." You know, that's what people don't want to see. They want to see this glossy, shiny lifestyle. You know, the look. But you know, what does well internationally is what's considered poverty porn to some in Philippines.
Yeah.
So I kind of get that, you know, people don't want to see you taking advantage of, you know, a certain situation.
People don't like to see reality either.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true.
We watch sitcoms rather than the news, probably. Yeah. What's next for you, Lee, after all this?
Well, I'm on this new show until May. I got another short I wouldn't mind doing, but it's quite expensive, so I got to think about that. And then I just started writing a feature yesterday, so hopefully. I mean, who
as
knows?
As he looks to the producer, no. Right? Yeah.
I have no idea what's next for me. Just keep swimming, really. Just keep swimming.
And this town itself, I mean, do you find it conducive to say, building a career as you have? We complain a lot about living in Vancouver, and so I'm wondering, someone like you who's in the creative class, do you find it, I mean, it's just as challenging as any other sector, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've been very lucky in the opportunities I've had here and the people I've met and everything. You know, I think it's hard anywhere, and it's like, I always just think about it like the Olympics, right? Like, if the game is 4 years away, that's so easy to just keep putting it off. But it's the ones who get up every day knowing the game is 4 years away and give 110%. Inevitably, they're going to go somewhere. So I could complain and talk about all the challenges, but I'd rather just get up and do the work.
Yeah. Well, long may it continue. Phil, what's next for you after this?
As I mentioned, I have the short starring Andrea Bang, which she co-wrote and directed by her sister Diana Bang and my longtime collaborator Mayumi Yoshida, who's also in this film. So, you know, it's full circle coming back with it. I worked with the Bangs last year for the Story Hive Karaoke Mamas.
Yeah.
And, I'm just kind of playing by ear. I think this year I do want to write a little bit more. Explore with possibly doing a film in the Philippines.
Yeah.
Something longer form. I'm not sure what that is, but something, you know, using our family's hometown, you know, of Ataun and Iloilo. Just the things I've seen there and with our cousin, Peter Planta, who's also my longtime collaborator as a cinematographer.
Yeah.
Just going over there and exploring, you know, based on what we've learned from shooting there. And just showing things from our voice, our perspective, but in that environment, it just adds so much more interesting storytelling and production value as well. Because, like, you know, what I'm finishing the film we shot 2 years ago in the Bicol region of the Philippines. That's finishing up soon, and we're trying to get it out to festivals and that sort of thing. And what I realize is when people see it, especially people from the Philippines, they're kind of like, oh, this is strange. This is weird. I've never seen this before. And that's what I learned from that experience, is like, always for myself, always go for the something I haven't seen before. You know, like, as opposed to trying to copy, well-worn formula. You know, don't do what you think the audience wants. Do something that you're really passionate about.
I was going to end the conversation, but there's something I forgot to mention. I can't find it in my notes, but I think I read it in Craig Takuchi's article in The Strait, that there is I guess, other than the funding that you get from Crazy Eights, is a little bit more in terms of getting this out to other festivals, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this year, Creative BC, because of the 20th anniversary, they sponsored an extra $500 for festivals, which, you know, if you look, for example, every festival could average...
There's a submission fee,
yeah,
right?
Submission fee of, say, $50 to $80, and then you want to enter 10 festivals, well, you're already at $500 to $800. Yeah. So that's been a great, great help, thanks to Creative BC, which is... you know, one of the big industry organizations supporting BC Film. And for us, that was because that happened last year with our festival submissions, was getting that extra money to put Gemini on the map, you know, and get it out there and get exposure.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to see this on Saturday. And
yeah, can't wait to see you there.
Congratulations, Lee and Phil, on this project. As Phil just mentioned, with that extra exposure, hopefully a lot more people will see this beyond Saturday.
Hope so, yeah.
Yeah, that's our hope.
Thanks for this, guys.
No, thank you. Thank you, Joe,
for
having us. Yeah.
At LC Shorten is Lee's Twitter handle. At Phil Planta is obviously Phil's. Crazy8s.film is the website for tickets. They have been known to sell out, so get them quickly. Lee Shorten and Phil Planta join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.